Okay, today is August 4th, a very beautiful day in Concord, and we're at the Concord Free Public Library. And would you please say my name is and tell us your name?
My name is David Wood.
And we never ask people's ages, but if you'd give us your date of birth, maybe we could put this in some sort of historical...
10/27/1950.
10/27/50, okay. And... maybe to begin, would you tell us about your people and where you were raised?
I guess from about 6 to 18 or so, I lived in Connecticut, in Weston, Connecticut. And, the, you know, so that's a majority of the school years, public school years. And prior to that, lived in Virginia, outside of Washington D.C. But my mother's family was from Connecticut, and my father's family from New York City. Like that.
Were there siblings? What?
Have I? I have four brothers. Four brothers. Mm-hmm. Yep. All older but one.
And how did your parents make their way in the world?
My father worked for the American Cancer Society for most of his career.
His name was?
Gilbert Congdon Wood. Let's see. He was with some national research group when we were in Virginia. I was born when he was in graduate school at Cornell. So that's in Ithaca, and he was at Cornell following his service during the war. He was a staff sergeant served on Liberty ships in. Shuttling prisoners from North Africa to Italy for a while.
Imagine that.
He described some of his experience to a degree, so I was able to imagine it. He was a non-combatant. He was a because his family are Quaker, so he was non-combatant, non-commissioned. Officer, medical. He was sort of a medical something or other. Mm-hmm. Like I say, he was pursuing his graduate degree in entomology, which he took from Cornell, 1952. And then went to work for, like I say, some government agency. Can't remember which. If there was an NSF, it might have been that, but I don't remember which initials it was. And then American Cancer Society, where he worked 25 years or so, something like that. So he worked in the city. We lived in the suburbs, and he spent half of each day on the train, I think, kind of like Emerson. Emerson spent an appalling amount of his life on a train. It's amazing.
I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, he was on the go like 6 months of the year, 8 months of the year, some years. Pretty amazing. If they had frequent something miles on the railroad, he would have cleaned up. He owned a stock in the railroad, so I guess he cleaned up.
And your mother?
Her family was from Connecticut, but she lived in Manhattan when she met my father during the war. She lived in Manhattan with her mother and stepfather and ran into him somewhere through her brother. He was on leave, that kind of thing, 1943, I guess that was. And... let's see. My mother worked. She'd worked for a little while as during the war as a, I wouldn't say nurse because she hadn't taken the degrees or anything, but she was at Bellevue during the war. And then did also worked for a while in the 1960s, worked for a while as I don't remember the distinctions, but she wasn't LPN. She was not a licensed practical nurse, but she was some kind of nurse.
And her name?
Janet Elizabeth, and she was born Robinson. And yeah, and then but she took the name Wood. Yep.
Yeah. So you're a curator at a museum. How,
yep.
How when did this interest developed for you in history and artifacts and all the things related to what you're doing now? Give us a sort of a developmental sketch of your own.
Okay. It can be hard to figure out how people become curators. There's no, there isn't any course of studies for it. So it's an accidental calling. I was, let's see, I got a degree in printmaking from the University of Iowa. That was Mauricio Lisansky's studio, an etching studio, a traditional etching studio, which are now gone, is my understanding. But so I learned etching more or less the way Goya practiced it. You know, that was Lisansky's thing. You know, that's what he did. So he trained many, many generations of traditional printmakers. And
his name is spelled?
Lasansky. He was a Peggy Guggenheim protege at University of Iowa starting in the 1940s. Late 1940s, I guess.
Now, etching is?
Is when you take a plate of copper and you put an asphalt ground on it and scratch through it and then put it in acid, and that makes lines. I don't see an etching in here. That makes lines in the plate that you can fill with ink, run it through a press, and then you get lines on the paper.
As in a dollar bill? Or?
Yeah, that's engraving rather
that's
than
engraving.
Etching, but... they're
What's the
related. They're both intaglio processes. Engraving, you use a burin, a little chisel-like tool, and you're going like this all the time.
And in etching?
In etching, it's more like drawing with a pencil on a sheet of paper, only you're drawing with a needle on a prepared copper plate. So.
What drives a person to study printmaking?
It's something to do, I guess. I don't know. No, it's I don't know. I would say it was. You have to kind of care about the technical side of things, and so this was my. I'm getting around to why I became a curator. So there's a technical aspect to it, but it's also possible. You can really explore the paper. You can look into the paper about what it is and how it's made and what its history is. And you can look into the techniques involved in etching. There's not much to it, actually. It's fairly simple stuff, but it wasn't really worked out until about 1500 or so. About the year 1500, it wasn't, you know, that technology wasn't worked out. But you know, then it was, and it didn't change since then. So that's kind of interesting. The prints that people made, I mean, you know, Rembrandt's etchings and Goya's etchings are, they're among the more moving monuments in the history of art, you know. So all you have to do is look at some of those things. Now, you can't emulate them necessarily, but it adds a lot of interest to the technique. So I explored those things a good deal and explored similarly explored some avenues in ceramics. Ceramics is the same sort of thing, only it's clay, which is a lot like glass instead of, you know, this print process. So it's got all sorts of aspects to it that are interesting technically. So I looked into a lot of those. But then, you know, after that program, I went into an art history program. After the printmaking program, went into an art history program
at
Boston University, the graduate school. And that was, you know, it made sense at the time. It was somehow a continuation of what I was doing with the, you know, with those media, you know, working in those media. While I was there, I was given an internship at the Museum of Fine Arts in the American Decorative Arts, the department was called then. And Jonathan Fairbanks was heading the department. So I sort of got hooked on that topic. And then I came here from there. I worked for maybe 2 or 3 years in that department, soft money, you know, various grants for 2 or 3 years, and then came here from there.
Because a job opened, or because there was
a
something
job opened here? Yeah, a job opened here, a curatorship. And this collection is a good collection. It's an old collection.
This collection.
The Concord Museum collection is one of the older collections of that kind of the artifacts of everyday life, more or less, because the collection was begun around 1850, and that's as far back as that interest goes, about 1850. So it was a good collection, rich in many, many different aspects. And so since then, I've been looking at a variety of aspects of Concord's history through the material that survives. We've got a lot of it.
Yeah, that was my next question. What do these things tell you about earlier life?
Well, the earliest things tell us everything we know about the cultures that they come from. So we have about 10,000 stone artifacts from the people who lived in Concord starting about 12,000 years ago up until about 1,000 years ago, or I don't know, 500 years ago. You know, that is all that survives from those early cultures is the stone artifacts. So, but the... there's a big group, you know, big is a relative term, but there isn't all that much that survives from the 17th century in New England, really. There's some very good 17th century things in the museum, and lots of 18th century things. And for instance, on the mill dam here, about 2 blocks from where we are, the mill dam, starting in 1790, was a manufacturing place. There was a trip hammer and wire drawing mill on one side of the mill dam.
A what?
A trip hammer and a wire drawing mill. A trip hammer is a water powered big hammer for forging out things. So that it was semi heavy industry around 1800, let's say, around 1800. And we have a lot of things that survive. And then across the street, we're a bunch of cabinet makers and clock makers, and they are all collaborating on making clocks, and they made lots of clocks. Concord made a lot of clocks in that 1790 to 1820 period, and we have a lot of them in our collection. So they are, you know, you were asking what the artifacts have to say. They are, those particular artifacts are particularly rich in information about one of the most interesting periods in American economic history, that transition from bench level manufacturing which is kind of, you know, bench level manufacturing is technology more or less on the same level as that etching process I was describing. You can do that with almost no capital and with very little in the way of specialized equipment. You need the press, that matters, but not too much else. And that's kind of the way it is with clock making. You don't need any capital. You can start out very small. You can, you know, just you and your tools. That's enough if you get an order. And so that they started from that. And then the father of the benefactor of this library started out that way as a cabinet maker. But then he made a transition around the year 1812 into another manufactory, and that was pencils, and that made a huge difference. His income increased tenfold, and he more or less became a much more recognizably modern individual. I mean, it's difficult to relate to the life of a craftsman in 1790, because it's just a foreign country, you know. It's just they start out when they're 12 years old and they work 10 hours a day, and their skill level is I mean, it's unbelievable. So he could do that, but then when he saw the opportunity, he switched over to something else, and that's where he starts to look a little more modern. That here he can do this wonderful, you know, hand crafting, which you have to imagine is, you know, like deeply satisfying on every level, especially if you read somebody like William Morris. He says this is, you know, here is where the dignity and labor is in this kind of work. And so the guy who was doing it said, I don't want any part of it. And he was quite right. If he'd stuck to the bench, he would have probably died in debt. But he didn't stick to the bench, and he thrived and prospered. So we've got the artifacts that document that transition, and a lot of the story is told in the artifacts and no place else. So similar, you know, it's a similar circumstance as that which holds for the stone artifacts, where the stone artifacts tell us everything we know about the culture they come from, because the language doesn't survive, the things that they made in bone and skin and wood don't survive, but the things they made in stone do survive. So that's all we got. And when it comes to the kind of manufacturing that Concord was doing in the early 19th century, most of the business records are lost, but all that survives are the objects. But the objects themselves, if you learn the syntax, the objects themselves are filled with information. So that's sort of what we do at the museum is use the objects as the database to reconstruct the aspects of Concord history that seem to matter. And since Concord's history has this tendency of crossing over from the local to the global on a few occasions, like April 19th, 1775, and also like, 18... the 1830s and 40s when Emerson and the people around him were in Concord, the subject matter is almost limitless. So it's, I don't know, keeps it interesting.
In this period of from 1790 to 1820, do you see technical development?
No, they were making clocks the same way people had been making clocks since the 1690s. It's almost impossible to distinguish an eight-day clock movement of 1790 from one of 1690. You have to be an expert to tell the difference. And the elements that really count didn't change. The things that are regulating the pace of the clock, they didn't change. Later they did. You know, after the middle of the 19th century, there were some developments in mechanical clockmaking that were a little different, but not hugely different. And then finally, mechanical clockmaking was abandoned altogether in the 20th century. But I forget what the question was.
Well, just the, if you could trace improvements or development in the...
Well, see, that's the thing. In a way, when you see the kind of activity, I mean, these people are at a certain point, they're making hundreds of clocks a year. And so you think, well, that must take, you know, you need a facility, you need capital and everything, but they didn't need any of those things to do it. And they also didn't really need any technical improvement along the lines of the things that economic historians tend to study. Generally, they're looking at things from a little later in the century, but the people who are working here, they used water power. They got a little assist from water power in a couple of aspects of, but they didn't use steam. There was no need for it. An example of technology they didn't need. So most of the technology they were using was, I would say, 17th century. But they're still working here in, you know, 1800, 1810. And then it ended. It ended completely with no issue. Nothing came of it. The clockmakers left. They didn't turn into railroad manufacturers or makers of light bulbs or any of that sort of thing. William Monroe became a pencil maker, and the people who stuck to the bench died in debt, but they had made a contribution that has yet to be worked out. It's like, well, what were they doing? And the clocks themselves are beautiful and admired and so on. But that may just be nostalgia. Don't know. Anyway, though, that's among the things that make them continually interesting, I would say, is that collectively, they're illustrating a way of getting a living that, as I say, is in part only told through the objects themselves. Because, like I say, most of the documentation is missing. The academic historians are decidedly people of the book. If it's not written down in words, it's usually invisible to them. So that's the... That's as I said, part of the challenge is to first work out the syntax and the taxonomy of American decorative arts has been very competently studied for half a century now. Anyway, I mean,
what does that sentence mean exactly?
The
taxonomy.
Well, if you have say a chest of drawers, an anonymous chest of drawers. Or let's say a card table. You've got a card table, and you look at it, and it's got a bunch of features, every one of which you can describe. And then you look, if you look at the record that's been assembled on material like this, as I say, in the last 50 years, then you'll find, well, that pillar in the center means that that's a relatively late card table in the series of card tables. And then some aspects of the carving would suggest, just looking at it from here, I'm not looking at the base, but looking at it from here, I'd say it comes maybe from upstate New York, or it's possible it comes from Massachusetts. I'd have to turn it upside down to tell. But the reason I can suggest that is because, these are all taxonomic features. It's just like when you're bird watching. Does it have a red breast? Well, it might be a robin. That's it. You just have your key list, and you just check the stuff off. So there are great collections of, as I said, the Concord Museum's collection was begun around 1850, which is very unusual. Most collections started much later than that. And the great collections were begun after 1900, really. The big museums didn't get into the American decorative arts game until the 1920s, and they started building American wings. But they made a real effort to gather together all the good stuff they could find, and that good, you know, what constitutes good is a moving target over the years. They changed their, the collectors changed their notion of what mattered, generally going from a purely aesthetic approach to a mixed approach, which is kind of where it is now. But they pulled all this stuff together, and then they spent a lot of time describing it very carefully, and so that's the taxonomy. That's what you get out of that. It, you know, it, does it walk like a duck? Does it quack like a duck? And so on. And so that, you know, you can use that to begin to read these objects for other information that's in there. There's, for instance, in there's that matter of training, as I said, you start young, you know, you're maybe 12 years old when you start doing this stuff, and you learn certain things and you never have to relearn them. You learn certain things once and never learn them again. Things like cutting a dovetail, let's say. You learn that once, you never learn it again. Most likely. There are rare exceptions, I expect, but generally speaking, you don't learn it again. So you can follow an individual through objects that way. That's something that an art historian named Morelli worked out with respect to primitive Italian painting in the middle of the 19th century, that don't look at the face gets repainted, the face is very sensitive to fashion. That's sort of the enemy of understanding these objects, fashion, because fashion is not regular. It's not regular. It's discontinuous. But there are aspects to furniture making that are much more continuous than fashion. So you have to not look at fashion, look at something else. And so that's where the... as a consequence, a lot of the things that were made in America for use in the home can easily be sorted out into time and place of manufacture to with a lot of accuracy and very fine detail. You know, in our case here, I can tell you which side of the block certain things were made on. But like I say, Concord's an unusual place. the cabinet makers were only on one side of the street on the mill dam, who was on the other side of the street? The blacksmith was on the other side of the street, so you can tell which side of the street certain things were made on. But you can do that for, you know, Newport, Philadelphia, New York, and that's because of, you know, all this work that's been done. You know, typing these things out, how to tell where they... So you can get it down to the individual level, down to the level of the individual, and that's when things get interesting, because these are real people that conducted real lives, and that was something, for instance, that interested Henry Thoreau, and Thoreau expressed an interest in that subject in his journal, a sustained interest in that. He made the claim, Thoreau did, that the sort of thing that he read, not in the official histories of Rome, which, you know, tells you what battles they fought and what borders they established, but Thoreau liked to read the pastoral poets, you know, Virgil and Varro and Columella, and made the comment that was real life. He sees people in Concord's fields every day conducting their lives exactly the way the people that Varro described were conducting their lives, and it puzzled him that they were invisible to the historic record. So he looked around for these people, how he could find. He also saw them in the street in Concord, and nobody else seemed to see them. You know, he would see people and that were just not, they were non-entities, and they don't show up in the official record, it's true. They didn't have jobs, they didn't hold property, they didn't hold public office, they didn't have higher education. there's no permanent record. You know, they're just, but Thoreau would meet them, talk to them, found them interesting, you know, he would learn from them, and it puzzled him that they weren't to be found in history. So he actually used some of the same records that a material culture historian would use, things like account books. Thoreau did, would read account books, he would read diaries, and Court of Common Pleas records, probate court records. He did that anyway as a surveyor, but he learned things about everyday life that really interested him, that made everyday life look to him more like the life of nature that he was recording at the same time. I mean, this is all going on at the same time that he's making that very extended series of very close observations of, for instance, blooming time of plants in Concord. For I think, 20-year period, he recorded the blooming times of 500 different species. That's amazing. That's an amazing thing to do. It taught him something about the world. Emerson said, and I think it was true, that Thoreau once told him he could wake if he woke up in Concord, you know, out of some coma or trauma. He didn't say coma, but if he woke up in Concord, he could tell what day it was in the year, even if he really had no idea, by looking at what was in bloom. And toward the end of his observational life, that was true. It was true. He could tell within a day or two. So he was making a similar set of observations about history at the same time for, as far as I can tell, for the same reasons that we make similar observations at the museum. There's no other record, but we do have these objects, and as it turns out, they have things to say about the way people conducted their lives in the past that you can't find anywhere else. You can't find, and on some occasions it's significant. On some occasions, I suppose it's just sort of adding color to a black and white image. But in some cases, again using the example of the stone artifacts, in some cases it's all you got. In the case of clocks, the documentation is very, very scarce. So all you have is the clocks, but you can read them. You can read their movements, and you can read their cases, and you can reconstruct ways of living that, like I say, are otherwise invisible. And since some of those ways turned into the modern world, unquestionably, the exercise can have a little value to it. For instance, what things didn't work. It's still a concern for economic historians: is what are the blind paths? What are the paths that lead nowhere? Things like bundling debt doesn't lead anywhere. We tried it. We gave it a real good try. Didn't work. And hopefully that'll be a lesson remembered. And
bundling debt.
The thing that's responsible for the recent turmoil in the financial markets.
They already knew it back then in Concord.
No, they probably would have tried it if it had occurred to them. They did similar things. That is, it's an interesting point. It doesn't, but you could, let's say you could imagine that the roots of that behavior can be found in the economic life of Concord in the 18-teens. What the heck? Let's say that's the case. There's enough evidence to make some progress along answering that question. I think the answer would turn out to be inconclusive. But they were doing what you would learn along the way is that they had attitudes toward debt and profit and pay that just don't make sense to us. So, for instance, a craftsman who could do wonderful work was generally only paid for time and materials. And you really have to wonder why they were doing it. But there's a passage in The Voyage of the Beagle where Charles Darwin describes the life of miners in Chile in the 1830s. And what these guys would do was go down a 400-foot vertical shaft by means of notched poles that were let in angles along the wall. They'd go down there with this pack on their back, and they would load 200 pounds of copper ore into that pack. Darwin lifted one of them. He said he could barely lift it, and he weighed it, 200 pounds. So they would carry this 200 pounds up these notched poles 400, 800 feet vertically, 400 feet at least. Darwin also says 800 feet, but that was for gold mining. But whatever. You're carrying a pack vertically for 400 feet, and they would do it 12 times a day. They would come to the top, wipe the sweat off, and go back down and repeat that 12 times a day. And on the weekends, they would get drunk. So why did they do that? And it's kind of like that for a cabinet maker like William Monroe. Why would he, and that was the thing that he confronted in his own life and decided this is a stupid idea. Why would you only work for time and materials? You're never going to get anywhere. You just, and that's it. He could charge about $1.50 a day for his labor. If he charged more, people wouldn't pay it because there are a bunch of guys in Boston, including a bunch of expatriate English who were driven out by economic conditions in England, who would work for $1.50 a day and do beautiful work for $1.50 a day. So he's got to compete with that. That would be an example of a lesson that has yet to be explored. It won't get you to the derivatives markets, but there are. If you go a little later on, say around 1907, you will find people in Concord are participating in the global economic market at a very sophisticated level. They still are now, and there is a certain continuity there. They're the same families in some degree, to some extent.
This is absolutely fascinating.
That's what I think. That's why I do it.
were the pencils, were Monroe's pencils in any sense mass produced? Was this the beginning?
You'd have to redefine mass produced because he actually used the same tools and technologies that he was using for furniture making early on. But there is something that happened. This is something that Adam Smith actually talks about in the first chapter of Wealth of Nations, that there is an invention activity that's carried out at the bench level. So in other words, the craftsman at the bench, the guy who's sawing something out or hammering something out or something like that, he will spontaneously, according to Adam Smith, and there spontaneously is a tricky word, but it just means you're not adding any more energy to the system to get more out of it. Or at least something different out of it. So spontaneously, these workers, this is Smith's account, would invent things to make their task easier. His example was and he cites this as a true example, a young craftsman at the bench, and his job was to regulate some machine that when at a certain point, and this is in the 1770s, so this is very early, 1770s anyway. So his job is to, at a certain point, he's got to throw a little something or other, and then the machine will keep on doing what it's doing correctly. Well, he wanted to play with his friends, you know, this 13, 14-year-old kid probably. So he invented a little jig that would automatically pull that thing, whatever it was, at the right time. In other words, he put a feedback device onto his machine. And so that's going on all the time at the bench level. There's a continual process of invention. And that was the case with Monroe. They invented little things to make the task easier, but basically it's the same. He was taking thin planks of cedar. He was making regular grooves in them, square notches, or, you know, angled notches in them. He was slitting them. He was filling those angled notches with a preparation of graphite, then gluing two sides together, and then you know, separating all those things out, and you've got a whole big bundle of almost pencils. And then you cut those up and sell them as pencils. So he was doing that, but he was taking orders as early as 1815 or so. He was taking orders for 20,000 gross of pencils. That's 20,000 times 144. And he said he could deliver it. That guy failed, so he didn't have to deliver it, but he delivered thousands of gross of pencils. And so they could do that without any, there's no machines there really. There's little tricks in the shop that made things a little easier, but he never had to build a mill. He didn't use water power, although he may have used water power to saw out the cedar. It's not clear. But he certainly didn't use steam power. He didn't need any capital. Didn't have to borrow any money from a bank or from anybody else. He did it, he came out of that bench tradition and you know, grew this other thing. And that, now that changed, finally that did change, but it wasn't his work. He made pencils that way, started buying stocks, and then moved out of pencils and just, but by then he had $500,000, which is a ton of money in 1850. But he did it.
Did he have an advertising department in the shop?
Nope.
How in the world?
He sold them wholesale. He developed a network of people who would buy them. He started out, he had one customer, a guy named Benjamin Andrews in Boston. And that was enough. That was in 1812. And Andrews was taking orders. He was fulfilling orders for Andrews of $250 a pop. Several different, order one right after the other, orders for $250 a piece. Prior to that, the biggest order was about $38 for a piece of furniture. You know, that's about it. So he just made this big leap right off the bat. And
what did the pencils sell for on the street?
A few cents. But he didn't do that selling. He didn't sell retail. He sold wholesale. And they'd go to stationers, mostly in New York, and then they would sell them maybe 2 cents a piece, about 2 cents a piece.
Were other pencils available at that time?
Yeah, he benefited from the interruption with the British trade between 1807 and 1815. That's when he grew his business. So he benefited from the interruption of the English trade. The English made better pencils than the Americans, and the Germans made better pencils, but they were more expensive, and he was able to, and they were not available with the embargo. So he was able to, you know, put this business together and get enough customers and then ride it out. When the English pencils were available again, didn't make any difference to his customers. They could still get as good a pencil as they wanted from Mr. Monroe, and they were satisfied. So,
well, given the traditions of writing in this town, it seems it's just so interesting that this is where the pencils.
Well, they didn't write with pencils; they wrote with pens. Yeah, that's the other question. Then that it'll be for other people to sort out. Why was there suddenly a big market in pencils just around the year 1812? Because there was, where there wasn't before, suddenly there was a big market for pencils. And it might have something to do with the public schools. There was a big order for children's books at that same, a big demand for children's books at just the same time. And the production of children's books went from a very few to a tremendous amount. The difference between 1780 and 1810 is several orders of magnitude when it comes to children's books. In 1780, a few very lucky children would have a book made specially for children. In 1810, every kid in America had a book made specially for a child. So that's a big difference, and maybe pencils go along with that.
So that's who was using pencils, children?
Maybe. What? Don't know. I actually don't know. Haven't had to figure that one out.
Carpenters?
Carpenters use pencils, it's true. And they made, and ship carpenters use pencils, and they made special pencils for carpenters, but the bulk of the pencils were pencils. There are others who made fine art pencils, you know, pencils meant for drawing. Those were expensive, and they were specially refined and everything like that. But and you could get colored pencils and things like that too. But the general pencil, it's not clear to me where they were going. I think it's an easy question to answer. I've just never looked into it. But I know, for instance, that in the 1760s, one big order of expense for a school, this is John Tilliston's North Writing School in Boston, a big expense for him was quills. He was buying them by the thousand. So at some point, the pencil replaced the quill. And there was a big crash in the goose feather market, and everybody who'd invested in goose feathers was, you know, busted. I'm kidding. I made that part up.
What are some other areas to talk about in terms of the artifacts at the museum?
What other? Oh, well, there's lots.
For example, do you see any technological advances in the stone artifacts over from 12,000 years ago?
Yeah, well, that's outside of my. You can see changes. The difference between 12,000 years ago and 3,000 years ago is, you know, even I can see it. And I don't specialize in that department at all. The difference between 3,000 years ago and 1,000 years ago in a stone artifact, I can't tell the difference. One thing that you get 1,000 years ago that you don't get 3,000 years ago is a ceramics technology in this area. You get ceramics earlier elsewhere, but in this area, it's, you know, 1,000, 1,500, 2,000 years ago. Well, 2,000, 2,500 years ago, you get ceramics. You get bone. Sometimes bone things will survive. Maybe they were there earlier on and they don't survive. Don't know. It's hard to say. But there were, I mean, the introduction of stone technology has a beginning. The introduction of people into this area has a beginning. It was as soon as the glaciers left, people moved in. They brought a stone technology with them that they probably, I mean, a good guess is that it came from the Southwest, the technology did. But you'll get areas, it didn't happen here, but you'll get areas where there are these sudden, it's kind of like the Cambrian level where all of a sudden, you know, where before that there's no variety in life forms, and then at that level there's enormous variety in forms. There's certain areas like along the Mississippi where there's huge variety in stone technology, not here. And also those were short-lived little things. It's not an area I study, so I'm not even sure how people are theorizing about what was going on there. But there is a history of technology there, but it's a rather slow-moving one, I would say, for the most part, until the end. And the end came quite suddenly, with the advent of the Europeans, ended the stone tradition completely.
And the makers.
Moved west.
Abruptly, you say?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep.
What's the story there?
What do you mean?
Who was here and where did they go, when and why?
Well, there were people who spoke languages in the Algonquian group, apparently. And they used to live in this area, in an area that stretched over the course of a year, that stretched from upstate New York to Gloucester, say. And then, let's see, where did they go? Most of them died in a series of plagues, especially the 1627 plague. About 1 in 10 survived that encounter with European disease in this area. It's different parts of the country, but in this area, all but about 1 in 10 died. And then some of the remnant became Christianized. And there, you know, there's still a few people around. There are still a few people around. There wasn't any, I wouldn't say there was any, at least that I've never heard of any migration out of this area. In other words, it would be like one family group at a time. So after that big die-off and after the, you know, there were wars and they, you know, we took the land away and, you know, pushed them out and stuff like that. But there wasn't anything like the Cheyenne, like, you know, like marching the Cheyenne from Florida to Oklahoma. There was nothing like that up here. You'd ask where those people went, but I don't know. It's not really my area, but that's as close as I know to where they went.
Well, let's get back to your area. Yesterday, Rick Wheeler took us to his home and showed us, among other things, a shooting piece hanging on the wall. And he said that Concord was a great producer of firearms over the.
Well, there was one little episode of firearm manufacturing on the mill dam. A guy named Alvin Pratt, and he did all right. He made thousands of muskets and rifles. He made them for the militias. Almost every young man was a member of a militia, needed a firearm. And he also made sporting guns. There was a lot of sport shooting in this area in the early 19th century. He had a kind of specialized product. He made very accurate sights and found a niche market for that. But that was about it. There was a little bit of manufacturing before that. There was gearing up for the revolution. There was a little bit of manufacturing, a guy named Samuel Barrett, and there were probably one or two others. Earlier on, there was a barrel maker in Concord as early as 1710 or so, and there were probably a few others that I just don't know about. But it was never, I mean, this wasn't any Springfield or anything like that. It was never a big trade, except for that little period in the 18-teens and 20s when Alvin Pratt was doing a lot of business.
Did he sell rifled barrels?
He did, yeah. We have his rifling bench in the collection, actually.
Where does rifling begin?
In Germany.
About the same time?
No, in the 17th century, 16th century. Depends on who you talk to. It wasn't used commonly until the early 19th century, I'd put it that way. There were a few, there were rifles available in the 1770s, but they were uncommon. Conversely, in the 1840s, rifles were common. And then by the middle of the century or a little after. I mean, most of the muskets used in the first 3 years of the Civil War were smoothbore. They weren't rifled. It probably saved a lot of lives. rifles are much better at killing people than smoothbore things are.
Those are much more accurate.
They are, yep. So, Concord was a depot for military stores beginning in the 40s, the 1640s. So there was probably always a little kind of fringe kind of stuff going on, but it was numbers were always very small. That great leap forward in manufacturing had yet to come. And most of the needs could be survived with imports, could be provided with imports, satisfied with imports. So it wasn't until later. But anyway, I'm not sure what episode Rick might have been talking about, but probably Alvin Pratt. That was the biggest, most organized, and it wasn't very big.
How and when were those decisions made? You know, when should we import, or should we become a self-sufficient manufacturing crafts community?
Nobody ever asked that question. They just got on with it. Until much later on. Much later on, it became an issue. That is certainly part of the prelude to the revolution, is that part of the philosophy, the mercantile philosophy, is that your colonies ought not to manufacture. They had figured that out. They knew the difference between raw goods and manufactured goods, and they knew that the profit was in the manufacturing and the shipping. And so there were actual legal, organized efforts to not allow Americans to manufacture for themselves. So there was a lot of cheating. You know, for instance, the iron, you weren't allowed to make iron in America. But Concord had an iron foundry by 1678 or so. So what do you say? But it really was the case that they weren't supposed to do that. And it got worse and worse as time went on. And then it became a political issue. Say in 1786, 87, 88, the time of Shays' Rebellion, that notion of imported goods became a moral issue. And the rhetoric, at least, was don't buy these imported fancy goods. It's not good for your soul, for one thing, but it's not good for the economy, for another. They knew that by 1787, and so would pass resolutions. You know, the legislature passed resolutions to that effect. You know, don't buy Chinese export porcelain. Well, if you don't buy Chinese export porcelain, then Salem goes out of business. So, it didn't really catch on, but they were aware of that fact. It's still not solved, obviously. You know, should we manufacture cars or import them? What's the answer? You know, we'll have to ask Washington. Should we manufacture cars or import them? So I'd say the question is still unanswered, and still only imperfectly asked, even. They're not quite, I would almost guarantee that none of the present legislators are aware of the fact that they're debating a question that their like has been debating ceaselessly for 250 years. But it is kind of the same question.
And so as a historian, I mean, how do you regard that notion, you know, which sustains community? Concord in particular.
Right. And it changes over time. Concord's had a couple of episodes of, you know, that idea of sustaining community. Concord's had a couple of manufacturing episodes. This is this one on the mill dam that disappeared entirely about 1822, 23. Vanished, gone, never to come back. They actually drained the mill pond, widened the road, it's over. They put up new buildings for new purposes, insurance and banking. And so manufacturing left the center of Concord. But it didn't leave West Concord. There was a textile mill in West Concord that was quite active in the middle of the 19th century. Then railroads, the railroad junction came there, and the prison came there, and this little manufacturing community grew up there. And for a while in the early part of the 20th century, right through to the maybe 1960s, almost every kid in West Concord worked in either in Boston Harness Company or the Concord Woodworking Company, or Bluene. Bluene made bleach and sold it. By an interesting marketing process, they would enlist children to sell this stuff to their door-to-door and give them premiums for it. And they were doing this by the 1860s. And they lasted for quite a while, 70s, I guess, maybe seven, let's say 70s. But they always, you know, they needed somebody to put the stuff in the little paper things and fold them up, and that's what you do after school, you know, in 1920. And so it did make for a sense of community that, you know, there are echoes of it in the Oral History Project, plenty of echoes in the Oral History Project, Concord's Oral History Project so far. I think that sense of community, absolutely, you know, it's like everybody participated one way or another. Now, that's not the case. And you know, as I say, it was the case in Concord, especially for boys. Boys had license. They had more license than girls did. And they would wander around. They would just wander around. And they were allowed to poke in to almost anything. It's really kind of interesting. And so they would wander into the manufacturing shops on the mill dam. So here's, you'd walk into the blacksmith shop and watch him work. I'm sure it was great fun. I do it at Sturbridge Village. I just watch that guy work. I don't want to talk. I just want to watch him work. and they'd pick stuff up. You know, they'd learn stuff from that. Now, they're not going to go be a blacksmith, but they'd learn stuff, and I'm sure they'd pick up the gossip and you know, but they were ubiquitous. It's something that Thoreau writes about, because he was one of them. He grew up on the mill dam when the mill dam was an active place, and he used to wander around town and just poke into everything, and so he knew everything. They all did, and then he still writes about it in his journal. He'll be talking about something like, you know, it's time for the huckleberries. The boys have already been there. He'd say the boys have already been there. So they've already found the bushes. They already knew they're ripe. They're already there. Here's Thoreau, you know, the best naturalist America's ever produced. The boys got there first. And same with bird nests. And when the powder mill blew up in Acton, Thoreau, you know, we're about two doors down from Thoreau's house. He saw the mushroom-shaped cloud from his house, about two blocks from here. Powder mill blew up in Acton. And so he saw he heard the boom, and then he saw the cloud. So he walked over there. The boys were already there. You know, they were literally pieces of people hanging from the trees, and the boys were just, they were there, checking it out, see what's going on. And, you know, so there was that community. They were sort of integrated into those aspects of life with this amazing amount of freedom. I mean, there was nobody checking their movements. I mean, when they're in school, when they're working, that's one thing. But a lot of these kids in the middle of town aren't actually working as farmers. They're doing something else. They're probably going to school, you know, and they might go to Harvard. But when they're boys, they have this license, and they took advantage of it. The reason that prior to the Oral History Project, there was that Social Circle memoirs, that series of Social Circle memoirs. Some of that information comes from those Social Circle memoirs, because these are people in the 1860s and 70s writing about what Concord was like in the 18 teens and 20s, and they mention that we used to do this, we used to do that, you know. Not enough of it. I wish they'd put down more, but it's still, they're rare accounts. And regrettably, there's almost nothing from women that's comparable. Almost nothing. So that's, you know, that is too bad. But I don't think there were packs of girls wandering around Concord's fields and woods and the mill dam and stuff like that. At least I've never seen any account of it. But the boys were out there.
You chose packs rather than gangs?
Well, I don't... I've never seen any evidence of the kind of bonding activity that I would associate with a gang. These were casual congregations, as far as I can tell. There was a little bit of organized stuff to it. For instance, skating on the mill pond was slightly organized. We have the testimony of one boy as to who was the best skater on the pond. So you would know that. You'd know who the best skater was. But it was Henry Thoreau in his day. It was a guy, it was the son of a clockmaker in 1810, was the best skater on the mill dam. I don't think gang would be the right word. And what relationship this activity has to the urban activity where packs of apprentices are actually making history, that's the people that Samuel Adams and James Otis enlisted to be the mob in Boston, it's a similar activity. It's similar. The apprentices, the apprentices are, they're 12 to 16, 17 years old. And they would hang together. And occasionally they would behave coherently politically. So it's probably got some relationship to it, but just what it is, I've never seen elucidated. Again, there aren't too many. There just aren't any resources like the Social Circle memoirs for other communities. Generally, you'll get one account, and then very often there'll be one minister who pays attention to these things and gathers, starting in the 18-teens. And William Bentley in Salem is a great example. Will gather all the information he can about everyday life in the old days, but it's just one at a time, and not. It's just not the same. There's something statistical about the Social Circle memoirs that makes it slightly more valuable, I guess, in that regard.
Is that a class-based document? Sort of the name implies the Social Circle.
It's a dinner club that has 25 men who met for dinner on Tuesdays during the winter months, basically. Starting in 1783, more or less, and still going. But there was an initiative in the middle of the 19th century to write memoirs of deceased members, and they did it. They stuck to it. They had to write the memoir. They had to reconstruct the memoirs for the first couple of generations, but they got some remarkable information. There are things in there. That just aren't known for any other reason. There's a silversmith in Concord who was a member of the Social Circle, and I'm pretty sure it's still the case that the only reason I know that he had a journeyman in his shop is because of the Social Circle memoir. And I found I found that name, and then I found out who this guy was and where he was trained and everything. But otherwise, he doesn't show up. He doesn't show up in the assessor's records. He never held town office. He wasn't a member of the first parish and so on. So he was not in any of those social structures that leave marks, that leave tracks. But he didn't escape the net of the Social Circle memoirs. So that's what it is. It's this sort of finer net for those accidents of history, those unrecorded. Those that are unrecorded in other media, generally. So that's what they are. And as I say, it's really an antecedent for the. They are oral histories.
Fascinating.
They're oral.
Mm-hmm. Yep. In a way, yeah. Because they're not using written records to construct them. It's just like, it would be somebody saying, I remember. When I was a boy on the mill dam, we used to do this. He says, you know, the jurors were a hard set. He was talking about the journeymen. They were tough guys, you know. That's the only place that I have ever seen that information. And when, and as soon as somebody says it, you go, you know, I bet he's right. Because the journeymen, they don't own property. Very often they're not married. They're not in the church. They're not in the militia. They're not in the fire department. Who are these guys? Bunch of tough guys, and you stay out of their way.
And what do we know about circles of women and the craft of women's lives? Or do we?
Well, I would say it starts up right here, exactly where we're sitting. And that's Mary Merrick Brooks. And the Anti-Slavery Society, you know, the record starts becoming really, really good, and you can see what Concord women were doing. But prior to that, it's very, very hard to find out. We've got many, many examples of what girls did when they were in school. We have a wonderful collection of schoolgirl needlework. And you can read from those certain networks. You can see where they went to school. Some, you know, some Concord girls went to school in Boston, and some didn't. And so you can read that from the artifacts that survive. Just trying to think, where else is it? Where else is it? Because the And then, so they would do this stuff, and they could do this. It's parallel to William Monroe in a way. He could do this wonderful, wonderful work with woodworking, and he stopped. He said, "This isn't what I should be doing. I'm not going to do this anymore." And women could do wonderful, wonderful work with ornamental needlework, and then they would stop. They would get married and have a family, and they didn't do the ornamental needlework anymore. And for us, it's difficult. You go, "Wow, if you could do that, why wouldn't you do that? These things are beautiful, you know." Well,
they didn't take it up again in old age?
Generally, no. There's an exception that we have represented in the collection, and she really is the exception. One woman in Connecticut. There are others, but I mean, there's one kind of standout where she was really. Now, there were. I don't know. It's a complicated subject, and complicated by the fact that early on it was men's work. The professional ornamental embroidery was men's work. The amateur ornamental embroidery was women's work, and that goes back to, that goes back to Penelope, doesn't it? Wasn't Penelope working? Penelope was working at her loom when Ulysses came home. For a certain class, but the professionals were men, and that I think held. With only a few exceptions, that held in the American experience too. But that richer record of women's lives in Concord does begin in the 1830s. And then the record gets real good indeed. And there are people who have been doing wonderful work with those circles. That includes Thoreau's family, his aunts and sisters, and so on.
You look at these homes and you think there must have been a lot of women working to maintain them. Can you talk about that class of people and those harder women, or whatever you want to say, that would parallel?
Who were they? They people had help in their homes. I'm trying to think of an example. I mean, there are exceptions, but they're kind of treacherous because as soon as you see a woman, say, in the 18th century, behaving in a modern way, It has certainly tempted historians in the past to attribute all sorts of other modern attributes to whoever it was. And you do see that, but that's just error. That's just a you know, it's a mistake. That doesn't mean that they weren't modern people. It's all it means is that the evidence isn't surviving. And what I'm thinking of when I say that is a member of the Barrett family who gets credit for all sorts of, you know, things at the all sorts of activity in the onset of the revolution that really probably she didn't do. But that doesn't mean that she wasn't an interesting person, and it certainly doesn't mean that she didn't participate. I believe she did. But she wasn't Molly Pitcher. She wasn't Mrs. Adams. You know, but because there are examples like that, they tend to get projected onto those people. So it's obscure. It's just obscure. They're out there, but boy, are they hard to see. They're just hard to see. So what's going on in the houses? In the 18th century, even if you've got it, let's say you had an intact 18th century house with all its furnishings, let's say the old manse. It's not entirely intact, but it's pretty good. It's close. It's a good approximation. The fabric of the house itself is quite good. The furnishings are in part the 18th century furnishings, and the decoration is in part the 18th century decoration. The work wasn't done by women, and the decisions weren't made by women. What color the walls should be, it wasn't a woman who made that decision in 1768. You know, it was the guy. That didn't change until the 19th century. We have another example in the Emerson House. If you look at the Emerson House, Mr. Emerson had nothing whatever to do with the interior of that house. Not a thing. He didn't choose the carpets. He didn't choose the furniture. He didn't arrange the pictures on the wall. He didn't do a thing. So that transition happened between 1768 and 1850, let's say. But the work itself, trying to think what we've got. Yeah, I don't know. There's almost, it's very difficult to reconstruct. The things don't survive. There's no written record. And then the artifacts tend to be, you know, where is the pie? You know, where's the pie? Well, somebody ate it, you know. They ain't no pie. But somebody made that pie, and it wasn't a guy, except in the cities. In the cities, men were cooks, but... every now and again, there'll be a pocket, which is something that you tie around your waist, underneath your petticoat, and you keep your scissors and a few other things in there. You know, so every now and again, that's almost as close as we can come to an artifact of the working life of an 18th century woman or a 17th century woman. Literacy is makes it difficult. You know, lack of literacy makes it difficult. But there were clearly literate women in Concord, but nothing. Yeah, we don't really have any diaries until the 19th century, so it gets hard to. It gets very hard to reconstruct, and like I say, unfortunately, that makes it a playground for certain kinds of history that you can, in the lack of evidence, you can make up anything you want. So but like I say, that's an impulse that you just sort of try to recognize. And the example would be American Girl. Do you know the American Girl series? American Girl. It's almost as big as Disney now, I think. But it's these it's this series of what are called optative history books. In other words, what history would be like if I was there then and they had penicillin.